Okay, welcome back. For our next speaker, I'm delighted to introduce my friend and former colleague from Edinburgh, Peter Cale, who's now in Oxford, who's going to be speaking to us on Price's predecessors, Hume, Nietzsche, and subject naturalism.
Okay, thank you. The paper is not quite as advertised. I didn't have enough time to do Nietzsche as well as Hume in 20 minutes. So I'm only going to talk about Hume. I'd like to thank Anton for the organisation and obviously for the invitation. So here we go. Hume sees in Hume a particular form of naturalism that is distinct from the naturalism that's dominant in contemporary philosophy. Price's Hume, because Hume is going to... Price's Hume embodies the approach of a subject naturalist as opposed to that of an object naturalism. Object naturalism involves the ontological claim that all there is what is studied by science, and the epistemological claim that all genuine knowledge is scientific knowledge. Naturalism in general engenders what Hume calls placement problems, roughly problems concerning how we are to understand phenomena such as meaning, modality, and value, whose status is somehow problematic in the relevant natural world. Object naturalism seeks to solve these placement problems in familiarly problematic ways, such as reductionism, identity theories, and Canberra planning. Subject naturalism, by contrast, takes science seriously, but includes taking seriously what science tells us about us. It seeks to explain our thought and behaviour, and it also offers a different perspective on placement problems. It doesn't seek to solve placement problems in the material mode, namely in consideration regarding the objects themselves. Instead, it concerns linguistic behaviour, the use of areas of discourse, and asks, quote, how are we to understand the roles nobody's ever run into? How we are to understand the roles and the functions of the behaviour in question in the lives of the creatures concerned, whence its genealogy. For Hume, subject naturalism is theoretically prior to object naturalism, inasmuch as the latter needs validation from the former. Or, to put matters differently, subject naturalism can invalidate the presuppositions of object naturalism. For Hume, those presuppositions concern certain semantic or representationalist theses, something, and this is where I'm going to be deliberately vague, something to the effect that the discourse in the problematic area, objects, naturalism's presuppositions, is that they function by matching representations to distinct classes of facts or entity. Hume's guiding intuition is that if we can explain how natural creatures in our circumstances naturally come to speak in these ways, there is no further puzzle about the place of the topics concerned. End quote. Now, obviously much more will be said at this workshop about Hume's development of this view and by people far more competent than me to discuss it. However, as someone who works primarily in the history of philosophy, my interest will be with Hume's conception of Hume. I should have thought about this one. Now, historians of philosophy are prone to trying to correct what they take to be anachronistic readings of canonical figures and complain in various ways about how the text needs to be understood in the context in which it was written and in terms of the questions that they are asking as opposed to the ones that we are asking. Now, you may or may not be pleased to learn that I'm not going to do that. Now, although I appreciate and have often contributed to the brand of what's sometimes self-consciously called antiquarian historian of philosophy, I don't think it's the be-all and end-all of doing history of philosophy. For one thing, it encourages and or perhaps expresses a presupposition that there really is no radical discontinuity, and a more no, that's the wrong way of putting it. There's no radically brilliant and innovative thinkers whose thought really does represent a genuine break from the tradition in which they work. Now, I think actually Hume is one of those that precisely does have such a radical break. Now, he's not the first to try and offer a science of human nature in the treatise, but I think I think Hume is right about Hume in certain respects, and I think that what is radical about Hume's science of human nature is it does embody, broadly speaking, and subject to certain qualifications and particular areas, the subject naturalistic approach that Hume wants to encourage. So actually, I have found Hume's views useful actually as a way of understanding aspects of Hume, and I'll come back to this presently. Now, partly I found Hume's views useful, at least my probably unsubtle understanding of them, but never mind that. It's useful for me, whatever happens. Because Hume is taken to be a paradigmatic naturalist, but it's just remarkable how little discussion of what naturalism in Hume actually means is available. Now, the association of the ideas of Hume and naturalism was forged in Norman Kemp-Smith's groundbreaking work, but for reasons I shan't go into here, a good deal of what Kemp-Smith claims seemed to me to be actually flatly wrong about Hume on a whole host of issues. And secondly, the term naturalism in Kemp-Smith is Kemp-Smith's lexicon is actually a highly idiosyncratic one. But I won't say more about that. Now, only Barry Stroud's 1977 Hume really tries to understand the nature and implications of Hume's naturalism. But post that, for the most part, the term naturalism, when discussed by Hume scholars, tends just to be used and not reflected upon. But, kind of really boring point, but this strikes me as very, very odd, given how David Papineau construes naturalism in the Stanford Encyclopedia seems to be absolutely completely nothing like what's going on in the treatises of human nature. Now, Hume is the hero of many an object naturalist. As Hume puts it, Hume becomes the patron saint, the Saint Francis of modern metaphysics, the patron saint of ontological ascetics. And this is enshrined in Lewis's view that the world comprises the mosaic of local matters of particular fact, just one little thing after another. The world comprises distinct existences that are not necessarily connected. Now, in the traditional readings of Hume, causation just consists in these distinct existences satisfying relations of contiguity, priority, and constant conjunction. Now, if there is a present problem for causation, Hume here is just adopting a straightforward reductionist approach. Now, notoriously, such an ascetic view is too austere for most. And from Thomas Reed onwards, this conception seemed to completely disrespect the naive intention and extension of the term causation. Now, modern conceptions try to supplement, if that's the right word, this austere view with other notions like counterfactuals, powers, or necessitation relations. Other people here are much better placed to debate the success or failure of these attempts to fly from what Hume calls the pure faith of the Humean. But my topic here is going to be Hume himself rather than human developments. First, a note about Lewis's ontology and Hume's own views. To put matters somewhat crudely, it's worth recalling that Hume himself deliberately restricted all his claims to relations discoverable amongst experiences and signalled clearly his intention not to stray beyond that narrow compass. He thinks that we should be content with knowing perfectly the manner in which objects affect the senses and their connections with each other as far as experience informs them. This suffices for the conduct of life, and it also suffices for my philosophy, which pretends only to explain the nature and causes of our perceptions or impressions and ideas, end quote. So Hume appears to allow for a certain form of modesty where investigation is not guaranteed to carve out ontological joints. If this is correct, which is arguable, but I've argued a lot about it, Hume's naturalism is not obviously a metaphysical, whatever Hume's naturalism is not obviously a metaphysical doctrine, but seems to be something more epistemic. So if we take for nature, if we take nature in Hume to refer to the kind of experience transcendent reality that metaphysics deals with, then it's clearly debatable whether Hume is an object naturalist just on those grounds. He at least leaves it alive the possibility that our cognitive capacities are just not up to the job of living reality. Now that's a minor point, let me leave that, well, it's a minor point in this context, but clearly a major point in others. Let's leave that aside and return to causation. And I noted that there's a flight from the austere view. But now, recently I've been trying to fathom how Hume's austere view might have emerged in the first place, at the end of what is a long and rich and very subtle history of the metaphysics of causation. The reason I had to do this is I agreed to do what Berkeley described as the disagreeable thing of writing on the same topic twice, and more than twice in my case. And I got an invitation. The editor is a very nice guy, the press is prestigious, and the company of authors is a good one. I was the only person I'd never heard of. Accepting this, the submission date seemed such a long way away. Now, time came when I began to write on causation again, and my mind was elsewhere. I was thinking about the nature of status of Nietzsche's genealogical approach to morality, so at least Nietzsche's mentioned. So it was a slightly heavy heart when I began to rewrite or look at Hume on causation again. When I did, two things struck me again, though they had struck me before, with much more force and vivacity this time. The first is just how radical a break Hume's views are from previously metaphysical rich accounts of the causal relation, such as influxus, trope transfer, pre-established harmony, occasionalism, and emanation, go on about that. The second is, again, just how radically revisionary the view I've described earlier appears to be of what, if we think there is such a thing, our natural concept of causation. So Hume seems to be a radical break, and it seems to be a radically revisionary break. Now, a third thing remained, again, when I looked at this, which is my general satisfaction with the standard accounts of what motivates Hume's austerity. This is a very familiar view, namely that Hume is interested in giving an empiricist analysis of key terms and arguing that further key terms like force or power are not experientially grounded and so are meaningless. All that we can legitimately mean by cause is exhausted by regularity, and the rest is literally nonsense. Again, I won't rehearse my many worries about that story. But a fourth thing, when I looked at this stuff again, struck me and took on a sudden salience, which might itself owe itself to the fact that I was actually thinking about genealogy when I was forced to think about causation again. Hume calls his method, the method he uses to arrive at his account of causation, as seemingly preposterous. He calls it as such because he says that we have been examining our inference from the causal relation before we've actually explained the relation itself. He then somewhat gnomically excuses himself for his seemingly preposterous approach by saying, well, he's taken it because the nature of the causal relation depends so much on the inference. Now, to put matters somewhat bluntly, I've been putting everything bluntly this morning, so I just dropped that line. Hume arrives at his conception of cause not through an analysis, but an account of how it figures in inference. What the explanatory account reveals is the role of the concept in our lives, or key aspects of that concept, and further, that it doesn't function representationally. The story about causation emerges out of an account of what role cause plays in inferences. And the discovery is that the terms power or force express a certain psychological function that can be misinterpreted as expressing a claim about a stronger metaphysical causal modality. Now, this strikes me as very much the subject naturalist's invalidation of object naturalism and their placement strategies. It also explains why Hume can be so radical in a way that seems richer than simply declaring, "I can't find an experience, therefore the term is nonsense." So, some detail on that. Hume doesn't present his interest in causation as a self-standing interest in metaphysics. People still tend to forget that. His interest flows from the account of his inferential faculties. Causation, he says, is the only relation that can be traced beyond our senses and informs us of existences we do not see and feel. And since that is the inference he's interested to explain, we must endeavour to explain fully the causal relation before we leave the subject of the understanding. And essentially the same point is made in the inquiry, where Hume tells us that all our reasonings concerning matter of fact are founded on the relation of cause and effect, and in order to satisfy ourselves concerning the nature of evidence which assures us of the matter of fact, we must arrive at just how we arrive at knowledge of cause and effect. But now, since he's interested in causation because he's interested in inference, one would have thought he might do something like this, namely, here I will give you a definition of causation, because that's the relation upon which the inference is founded, and then seek to explain the inference in light of that definition. But that's precisely what he doesn't do. Instead, he simply introduces two elements which we... In the treatise account, what he does is say, I'm going to, as it were, look at this inference. And then he starts by introducing aspects that enter into the causation of that inference. So he starts by offering two elements that we typically judge to be true of causally related objects. And then he makes an empirical generalization very early on about what object, what features that are commonly denominated cause and effects have, namely that they exhibit contiguity and temporal priority. But it's far from clear at this stage that he's taking these to be conditions on an analysis. Instead, he takes them merely to be what's typical in entering into the causation of a judgment. So, although he offers, for example, an a priori argument for temporal priority of cause and effect, it's perhaps interesting to notice his utter insouciance to the success and failure of that argument. He writes that if this argument appears satisfactory, it is well. It is not, I will beg the reader to allow me the same liberty that we have made with the preceding case, namely contiguity, as supposing it such. For perhaps in the end we shall have found the affair of no great importance. So on the one hand, it looks like Hume has offered a metaphysical argument for saying cause must be temporally prior to the effect, but then he says, well, if the argument doesn't work, it doesn't matter. Because you will find the affair of no great importance. Such insouciance is warranted by the fact that he's interested at this stage in identifying what elements enter into the explanation of the inferences we make, rather than any constitutive claim. Constant conjunction is also introduced in this way. Later in the treatise, in a section entitled The Inference and the Impression to the Idea, Hume notes that contiguity and succession are not sufficient to make us pronounce any two objects to be cause and effect, unless we perceive the relations preserved in several instances. It is in virtue, it's in virtue of the fact that the memory of constant conjunction is required to facilitate causal inference that constant conjunction is then added to the term cause. Hence we have insensibly discovered the relation of constant conjunction whilst discussing, quotes, another subject. So he's not starting out by defining causation in terms of constant conjunction, but instead he's getting these notions out of them being the typical input into the reasoning faculties of human beings. These three elements eventually come together in the conception of cause as regularity, but they emerge from examination of what makes us pronounce any two objects to be cause and effect. The concept is extracted by how what inputs are into our inferential faculties. But it still might seem prone to Reed's gleeful retort that it simply fails to accord to our intuitions. But what Reed ignores, and what I have not yet mentioned, is that Hume famously gives us a second definition of cause, which is notoriously not even extensionally equivalent to the first, let alone intentional. What we have so far considered is causation considered as a philosophical relation, very roughly causation as it can be considered as the object of conscious attention. Hume also considers causation to be, though, a natural relation. And observations of objects standing in the relations just described, they're not observations that they stand in the relation, affect the inferential character of the mind. So he tells us that the source of the idea of causal modality, of necessary connection, is the determination of the mind brought about by repeated experiences of objects satisfying the first definition. He foreshadows this radical conclusion earlier on in the treatise by dropping the hint that 'twill perhaps appear in the end that the necessary connection will depend on the inference rather than the inference depending on the necessary connection. Notice that there's an implied target here, namely those who think that causal inference might depend on our having a grasp of objective necessitation relations between cause and effect. So, roughly speaking, you see that A and B have a power that grounds a necessitation relation, and then you infer on the basis of that grasp that A will cause B. Now, there's a long story to tell about that as well, but the main point is revealed in what Hume considers a perception of a necessary connection would involve. It would involve the capacity simply to read off just what effect and just what effect such and such cause must have, and furthermore renders it impossible for us to conceive the cause without its effect. But Hume thinks that we can never be in such a cognitive position. Nevertheless, he offers an account of why we think in these terms, something like it, in his much maligned account of the determination of the mind. For what he tells us is that the effect of repeated experiences mimics psychologically the cognitive consequences of what a supposedly genuine experience of power would entail. We acquire by a long term of habit such a turn of mind that upon the appearance of the cause, we immediately expect with assurance its usual attendant and can hardly conceive it possible that any other event would result from it. So Reed's claim that, as it were, it doesn't really get the modal aspects of our thought is something that Hume is perfectly aware of, but he offers an explanation of that modality in terms of the psychology. Because custom has rendered it difficult to separate the ideas, people are commonly apt to fancy such a separation to be absurd and impossible. So the immediacy of the inference mimics the reading off of an effect from a cause, and the psychological difficulty of thinking of the effect without a cause mimics the alleged inconceivability that a supposedly genuine grasp of a metaphysical modality would have. Now, this account seems to be very much in the spirit of the subject naturalists undercutting the object naturalist pretensions. The early modern period, accounts of causation approach to the topic from the perspective of an object naturalism, though in a way complicated by the fact that non-naturalistic solutions to the placement problem are available. But crudely, and very crudely, there is a problem of placing active force in the newly characterized natural world of mechanical. It was a problem motivated by physics that led to very different metaphysical solutions about how active force could be so placed. But Hume appears to undercut this dispute by giving a functional genetic account of the origins of causation, of the concept of causation. Metaphysics sought to find a metaphysical correlate for powers that, when for words that actually express a functional change in the mind that Hume seeks to explain. Just want to end by noting the difference between Hume's attitude and Hume's attitude, which is not a criticism but just a puzzle, and actually does tie into something about Nietzsche as well. Hume sees the subject naturalist conclusion to be something very surprising, new and extraordinary, and the sense of something really odd and counterintuitive. And Nietzsche takes the concept of genealogy to have all sorts of destabilizing effect. Now, is this simply down to the sheer novelty of Hume's approach, and is the lesson solely for philosophers? That we can speak with the vulgar, to paraphrase Berkeley, but the surprisingly reorientated view about modal claims is something so extraordinary that that it's the metaphysicians who are going to find this really very strange. Hugh, I think, doesn't seem to think that his functional genealogy is going to have any surprising consequences for the vulgar view. And I just don't know the answer to that. Anyway, so that's what I have to say.